I'll go first. This is from Sweet Bitter. So this is from early in the novel. I don't know what it is exactly, being a server. It's a job, certainly, but not exclusively. There's a transparency to it, an occupation stripped of the usual ambitions. One doesn't move up or down. One waits. You are a waiter. It is fast money. Loose, slippery bills that inflate and disappear over the course of an evening. It can be a means to those with concrete ends and unwavering vision. I grasped most of that easily enough when I was hired at the restaurant at 22. Some of it was a draw. The money, the sense of safety that came from having a place to wait. What I didn't see was that the time had severe brackets around it. Within those brackets, nothing else existed. Outside of them, all you could remember was the blur of a momentary madness. 90% of us wouldn't put it on a resume. We might mention it as a tossed-off reference to our moral rigor, a badge of a certain kind of misery, like enduring earthquakes or spending time in the army. It was so finite.
I can go next.
Okay. If you want.
I'm going to read from, my book is Tuesday Nights in 1980, and this is a part where a young artist from Argentina first moves to New York City. I don't think you need to know anything else. A new New York had emerged once Angales entered the world of the squat. The squat is the place where all these artists are living illegally. Spinning around him like a fabulous tornado, sucking him up and into it. The squat became more than a physical space. It was an idea, a movement, a group of people who traveled like a set of tentacles around the city, sucking the art and life out of every place they landed. Angales danced to the B-52s at Studio 54, made out with models at Max's, bummed cocaine from a performance artist with a silver-painted body, crashed maximalist art parties at minimalist lofts. He hung out hungover on velour couches in illegal event spaces, in what was soon to be called Soho but was then just the nameless hellhole where the streets went rebelliously against the grid. He shook hands with old men in sweat-ringed polyester whose lawn chairs might never touch a lawn. He witnessed the quintessential fire hydrant sprayings of the summer months when little children screamed from the pressure of the water. He smoked cigarettes with women who weren't wearing shirts because why would they? Never went to bed before 4 a.m. because why would they? Never ventured above 14th Street because why would they? And generally vibrated with the artistic adrenaline that the gorgeous downtown grime produced. It was the grime that was glamorous, he came to realize, the importance of destruction and decay that sidelined gain and growth, the way the artists gravitated toward the most destitute of places and therefore gravitated to one another, that made them all feel rich. In reality, they were mostly undiscovered and very poor. Somehow being poor in New York City was not dire or scary like it was back in Argentina, where the electricity would shut off for weeks or he and his sister might not have enough food. This new life, even after the newness had sunken in, seemed like a surreal and inconsequential portrayal of real life. It was almost like a painting of a life. He often felt as if he wasn't in his own body, as if things weren't actually happening to him, and if they did, they didn't count. Simultaneously, he felt everything more strongly, joy, excitement, claustrophobia, anger, pleasure, inspiration. He was more inspired to make art here than he had been in his life. Where he had begun painting as a way out of his real life, he now painted as a way in. He wanted to go as deep as he could into life, all the way.
And then I'm just going to read a short selection from the middle of the first story in my collection called Hibernation. And it's about a woman named Joni who lives beside a rock quarry with her husband. And one night after a series of weeks where her husband has started to throw their possessions into the quarry, he himself walks into the quarry and she sees him. So it's unclear to her whether he is drowned or whether he's still alive. A rusted Ford emerges from the woods and parks at a cliff across the quarry. It sputters black smoke out the back. Two men climb out. They push the truck straight into the water. Joni imagines the leaky plume of oils as the truck falls, the blink of headlights and the grinding halt of the motor. The water bubbles where the truck went under. The men strip naked and jump into the quarry, hooting at the cold. She's heard stories that the quarry is used as a junkyard and that dirty people wash there, but she hasn't seen it, It doesn't scare her to see it, really. Just old men soaping their beards in the green morning light. Joni puts her cheek to the mottled granite. She feels almost comfortable with the men swimming in the distance. She hasn't been sleeping, and she curls up, her breath slow, her body heavy, and then she's sinking down into the quarry. The water is green and backlit. When she touches ground, two plumes of silt rise like ink around her. She stands inside a circle of cars, their wheel wells silky with green moss. She steps around the beer cans that are wedged into the mud. The abandoned backhoes are tall as trees. The car's hoods are caved, their windows webbed with cracks. The bodies waver by in Joni's periphery. She can just sense the glow of their skin, paled from living so many miles out of the sun. Better lie down, she thinks, keep low to the ground. The quarry mud gives beneath her weight. The map of algae trawls for her sleeping body. It finds and covers her over. How silent the dream is. What a nice place to get some sleep.